Okay, the recording's on for all those that aren't here, so you can hear it too. Just in terms of Shnai and Mikra, so a couple of ha'aris in addition to the one we were just talking about with Josh, but the first thing that you notice is that bracha is given over to Avraham Avinu. So if you remember my story about the marionette, so I get the impression that there's a tremendous flow of a bracha that comes to the world, and that certain people, namely the descendants of Avraham Avinu, and not all of them, of course, were given this capacity of bringing bracha to the world. Originally, that was in the hands of a Kaddish Baruch Hu, and he's waiting to see who's going to be the marionettes that behave themselves. And you remember all their strings that are attached to all kinds of other mechanisms, right? Remember my mashal? You remember that? Marionettes? Anyone? No? Yeah. So that's Avraham Avinu. And then there's a lot going on between him and his wife, obviously, with Sarah. And he builds, we're told that he puts her tent together before his. Like, that seems to be an interesting ha'ara. It says, oh, hello, but it's spelled oh, hello. So apparently there's a remez here that he set up her tent before his. It seems right away to indicate the importance of the bias, the importance of the wife, and her role in the what it means to have a home, and how she's the fundamental part of that home. And
sure.
What?
Yeah,
but I don't think it's just a question of sort of like being polite. I mean, I think there's an inyan here, which is that you can't really have a proper home unless you have that wife that's able to have that proper atmosphere and direct it in the right way. You know, a lot of times, the husbands are the ones that are, they're working, not necessarily spending as much time with the children. And when a kid comes home from school, I don't know if this is typical anymore or not, but it certainly used to be typical, that the first parent you encounter is his mother. So you can imagine the regular scene. Kid comes home from school, did a few things that day. All right, let's put away the phones. Did a few things that day. And one of them was, you know, he finished a pair of machines. And one of them was that he hit a home run in a gym at recess, whatever, you know. So right away, the response of the parent, the response of the mother, typically, sets the tone for how the kid views his life. If the mother stresses how awesome it was that he finished a parak mishnayis, and it's very nice they hit a home run, but it's not really what life's about. So right away from the beginning, so the whole atmosphere of the bias goes in a certain direction. But if it's the opposite, then the atmosphere of the bias goes in the opposite direction too. So there's just a stress about what our value system is, and so that's the base level. What I mean to say is, those kinds of things are not taught. There's nobody that, I mean, we try to teach them. But there's, I'll say it like this. You ever heard the pasuk Shema b'ni Musar Avicha v'al titosh Toras Imecha?
Yes.
Nigeres Ramban begins that way, correct. So that pasuk is interesting because it says Shema b'ni, listen my son, Musar Avicha, to the Musar of your father. V'al titosh, don't abandon, reject, Toras Imecha, the Torah of your mother. So you see from here there's something called Musar of your father and something called Torah of your mother. So, what's interesting about this Musar Avicha and Torah from your mother is that the Musar of your father, Shlomo Melech, says, Shema B'ni, listen. Apparently, if you don't listen to it, you're not going to hear it. But what does he say about Torah Simecha? Al Titosh. Doesn't say Shema, that's what's interesting. Al Titosh. Don't abandon the Torah of your mother. I abandon it. You never told me to listen to it. How did I get it? So, you see from here that this thing that's called Torah Simecha, which I'll try to explain in a second, the thing called Torah Simecha is not the type of thing that you ever really listen to. What do you mean? That's what I'm trying to say. When you grow up in your home, there's certain things that were instilled within you that you never chapped, you ever attained, you ever got, you never realized it. Because it's just the atmosphere of your home is the way that you grow up. And the value system of your home, and the way we do things, and just the way we are as our family, that's what's called Torah Simecha. It's the kind of thing that you should never abandon because it comes from some kind of Masorah. But it's not the kind of thing you ever actively listen to. Musar Avicha, don't do that, don't do it. So that's already something else. That's something you have to listen to. If you don't listen, then you're never going to have it. So I think that's behind the scenes here. And the fact that Avraham Avinu is setting up Sarah's tent before even his is that is the tent. Sarah's tent is the tent. That's the baseline. That's where everything starts. And then finally, this whole idea that there's a Ra'av and a Kadosh Baruch Hu tests him. It's an unbelievable test. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling him, go to this land I'm going to show you, and then when he gets there, there's a famine. So we experience this all the time, that we have certain things that we feel are what we're supposed to be doing, and then as soon as we start to do it, it's all of a sudden, it like doesn't make any sense. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me? And we feel like, well, maybe that's a sign that I'm on the wrong track. Okay, so you see from here, that's not always the case at all. But to just assume that something's a sign I'm on the wrong track, maybe not. Maybe the nisayon is, okay, so this is the situation that Kosh Baruch Hu put me into. Maybe learning's not going so well. Maybe this, that, the other thing, whatever it is. But I got to plug away and I got to keep going. That's exactly what Kosh Baruch Hu was testing me to see if I'm going to listen to him, because that's the situation I'm supposed to be in and I have to make the most of it despite the challenges that we face. Anyway, then of course there's always inyani tznius that apply by Sarah. Very interesting. She's ba'ohel later on. And here, he didn't know that she was beautiful, like he never saw, and then all of a sudden, because they're traveling, and they're walking through all kinds of things, he notices her beauty that's never before. So of course, Rashi's a few pshat then. Maybe not, maybe it just means that now is the time to worry about it. But also, his first pshat is, and maybe he really, there was such a tznius between them, so he never really noticed exactly how beautiful she was. What in the world is that supposed to mean? So on some level, what it means is that when you have two people that are such tzaddikim, that, yeah, she's beautiful, but that's not the point, you know? Like, he almost doesn't see it. Some people even say that Yiska, her name Yiska, is because I call Sochen B'Yofya, that everyone, like, gazed at her beauty. Like, what does that mean? So others explain, anyway, people stared at her. It means to say that you could see almost through her because of her beauty. What do you mean? That her beauty was her neshama. It wasn't her body. She was one of the most beautiful people in the world, fine. But that's not what people saw when they looked at her. And that's a tremendous challenge of tznius. To be able to, a beautiful woman, but to present herself as a beautiful woman that has a beautiful neshama and not as some kind of whatever, is a challenge of tznius that apparently is possible. And that's something that we need to save for our daughters, to be able to prepare them in that way. There's something called beauty, and then there's something called being attractive. Being beautiful is appropriate as long as it's presented in the right way, but being attractive is not okay. We try not to do that. And that's where tznius comes in.
Is it true that she can see the future?
She was a Nevi'ah. I mean, she knew more than Abraham, right?
I read it in the book.
That what?
It's called something that she can see that, like, she saw the future.
Baruch HaKadosh, yeah. Avram, later on, when she wants to throw out Shmuel, so Avram Avinu doesn't want to do it. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Shema B'Koyla. You have to listen to her. She was very aware. Okay. So what we're going to do today is going to talk about a little bit of the history of the Masorah. There are definitely a lot of ways to do this. And what I'm going to do for at least part of it is use a sefer that no longer has a cover, but there's an article history series. I'm not sure if they still publish them or not, but they have a few volumes. One's called the Rishonim, one's called the Achronim, and in the beginning of this one on the Rishonim, they have a pretty awesome summary of what was happening in terms of the historical background to the Rishonim, and you get an idea where they're coming from and the development of it a little bit. And it's the first few pages really are really a really great summary of the whole thing. And this is totally falling apart. I'm not sure it's going to make it to today, but whatever. Okay. So first things first, let's try to get us to the period, some periods of time we're a little more comfortable with, and some periods of time we're much less comfortable with. Certainly as it became many, many more personalities, it becomes very hard to keep track of who is who. So when you trace it back to the beginning, of course we know, I used to have a Rambam in here, that the Rambam, see, he traces the entire Masorah to himself. And he actually lists everybody that from Moshe Rabbeinu until himself. So what are we talking about in terms of that? So obviously we know that with Moshe Rabbeinu, we know there's Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. Somebody asked me, how come the Trup isn't in the Torah? It's not fair. So I have a hard time leaning. Why isn't the Trup in the Torah? So Trup is Begeder Torah Shebal Peh. But the tomb, all of those things are like Rumas, there are additional elements to it. You know, like, for example, the Vilna Goyen had this comment that he said, when Vayigash Elav Yehuda. So that means that Yehuda came close to Yosef. So what's the trap? Kadma va'azla revi. Vayigashay love Yehuda. I don't know how smart I'm doing, but that's not sure. So kadma va'azla is Aramaic for got up and went. Revi is the fourth son, which is Yehuda. So, you know, you're not going to find that in every single pasuk in Chumash, it seems. But that was one that they always say in the name of the Vilna Gaon. But there's what to learn in the trap too. But it's Begedet Darsha Baal Peh. So you have already Takanos made by Moshe Rabbeinu. You have certain elements by Moshe Rabbeinu. Then you have Yoshua. You have the Zakenim. So what happened historically? Where does what we know as Darsha Baal Peh, the Gemara, all that, like, how does that work? You tell me. How does this all start? Okay, so you have something called the basic Darsha Baal Peh. That was passed on Ishmi Pi Ish without any discrepancies. Until what? Well, obviously there must have been shilas that came up. There must have been issues that came up. So how were those resolved? With the Sanhedrin. So there was a Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin sat in Lishkas Hadassah by the time they built the Beis HaMikdash. So there was a Sanhedrin sitting already halfway in, halfway out of the Beis HaMikdash. Not allowed to sit in the Beis HaMikdash. They sit on the outside part of the Beis HaMikdash. But they were sitting already juxtaposed with the Mizbeach. So any decision that came along, so ultimately was decided, and that became the official Tarsha Baal Peh. It could always be adjusted or changed or whatever, depending on if it was repealed, all of the details. And so that was what kept everything united and unified. Until what exactly? So Churban Bayis Rishon sent Klal Yisrael into Galus. And I wrote a really great article on this, if you're interested, on revisionist history. Was there one Beis HaMikdash or two? Was there one Geula? Or was there never a Geula at all? So the idea being that we generally, I guess, assume that when Klal Yisrael came back after first Beis HaMikdash, so that was like a Geula. And then unfortunately, we started it all over again. But it really is not true. And it's very significant for our purposes today to realize how much it's not true. When Klal Yisrael went into Galus after Churban Bayis Rishon, those communities began in different places of the world. Not too far away, obviously, but they began in those parts of the world. Jews already wanted, started to go, they certainly went to you know, to the local, to Babel. That was already Nebuchadnezzar. But they migrated to Babel. They started spreading out. So they went to Babel, they ended up in Spain, they ended up in other places. However far they went, depends on what the time period was, but they ended up in different places. And we know that when the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, not that many people came back. And Bavel especially continued to be a major Torah center. So even though that's why you have the Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi, ultimately. But we're not there yet. So what you have already is with Churban Bayis Rishon, you have the spreading of Klal Yisrael to places well outside of Eretz Yisrael, and they didn't all come back. So those communities built themselves up and built themselves up and built themselves up despite the fact that there was a Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. That Beis HaMikdash. So it's not considered a positive thing for the Jews. Shevet Levi was punished. They said you're not even allowed to have your Meiser anymore. You forfeited it. Whatever, all kinds of things. But it wasn't really a positive in terms of what should have happened with Klal Yisrael. It was an opportunity to fix the problems Klal Yisrael had, and we didn't use the opportunity properly. You can take a look. There's a good article. You can find it online. It was on one of the YU Torahs, but I'm sure it's under my name on YU Torah if you look for it. But the point being that so Klal Yisrael, some of them came back, certainly not all of them. And at that point, where you have the second Beis HaMikdash, and ultimately the Chashmonaim, so that's the time period of who? Who were the basic non-Jewish population? And what was happening in the non-Jewish world at that time?
So the Greeks,
and what happened with the Greeks ultimately? What was the shift? In other words, Hanukkah is what time period? It is the time of the Greeks. Look, whichever Greeks, right? And that was, did they destroy Beis HaMikdash?
No.
So that was the time of tremendous idolatry was still happening. Yeah. But what shifted by the time that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed? Who destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash?
Romans.
The Romans. The Romans were idolaters.
They got the priests and one of the gods.
I don't know. They turned Christian at a certain point.
Okay, so there was a split.
I don't know what time.
There was a split. there was a split in the Roman Empire. Because you can tell, well, the details, we're going to leave out a lot of details today. This is going to be like, whoosh.
That was hundreds of years after the destruction of the Second Missionary Church.
When they adopted Christianity.
Yeah.
But this, what happened ultimately was that what was Greece became Rome. And Rome eventually split, and Greece was pagan. What happened with Rome ultimately was that it kind of split in half between those that were pagan and those that had begun to adopt Christianity, until eventually Christianity took over. And the world shifted between this paganism and Christianity, ultimately between Islam and Christianity. So those parts of the world that became Christian and other parts of the world became very Muslim. So what was happening in Eretz Yisrael was the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Rome. Many Jews ended up going to Italy, Rome. Many Jews spread out all over the place to different parts of the world. So the time period that we're going to call, you know, the Anshe Knesset HaGedoyla, which is still Sanhedrin, so that's the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. That means that what we consider to be Tefillah B'zman HaZeh, all the things that are in the Siddur, all the things that are standardized, like texts that we have, so those all began, or maybe were formulated to whatever extent, in that second Beis HaMikdash period. So when we always think about Torah Shebaal Peh, so that's the time period that we're focusing on. So what types of personalities, what people were alive in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash from Gemara? Who are we talking about? The Tanoim. Right? The Tanoim. What are some big names talking about? Shammai. Hillel and Shammai. Yehuda Anasi. I mean, you're talking about the Tanoim, that those are the time period of the Mishnayos. So all of the Tanoim who are in the Mishnah, right? Mishnah is Tanoim. The voices speaking in the Gemara are all called Amoraim. So that's after Beis HaMikdash was destroyed already. And in Rabbi Akiva was what? Tana or Amor?
Tana.
He's in Mishnayos, right? Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva is a Tana. So Rabbi Akiva, not clear if he was alive when the Beis HaMikdash was actually destroyed. There's a little bit of a debate about that. But whatever it was, he was certainly alive and very strong and leading Klal Yisrael well after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So that's already the time period that's still considered the Tanaic period, the Tanoim. And then eventually there's a changeover, whatever it is, 300, to the time period of the Amoraim. So then you have Shlakish, Yochanan, and you have a big split. What's the big split? You have the big split between Chachmei Eretz Yisrael and Chachmei Babel. Because the Beis HaMikdash is no longer around. There was a Jewish population in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yochanan, you know, was like the biggie. And the main Torah center of the world was not Eretz Yisrael. It was in Babel.
You know that the Beis
HaMikdash? And after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash.
All the knowledge was from the Beit HaMikdash.
What do you mean?
From the Talmud Yerushalmi, where
that's the Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi was formulated in Eretz Yisrael.
And they lived with the Beit HaMikdash.
The Tanoim did. Until later Tanoim. Later Tanoim did not. They were like Rabbi Akiva. It was already after the Churban HaBayis. And then the time period of the Amoraim is wherever it was. I don't know, the 300s, whatever they say. And that's already way past Churban HaBayis. And that's when there was a very large shift. And there was this, the main yeshivas were in Bava, they were not in Eretz Yisrael. But there was still a lot of Torah happening in Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara relates a whole bunch of times that ki asa ravin, ki asa this one, asa. What do you mean asa? Asa from where? And he came from Eretz Yisrael to Bava. And the Talmud Bavli says that he came because it's being written in Bava. So ki asa ravin, amar Rabbi Yochanan. You find that, I don't know how many times in Shas.
After Korban Bayis Rishon, though, these Jewish communities that initially branched off, how were they having correspondence with the Jews that eventually made?
Yeah, especially the closer they were, the more correspondence they had. Sure.
So were there rabbis there? Meaning, were the leaders of these communities, or was it just like
in the time period of Tanoim?
This is during the Tanoim, no? There's these communities outside of Eretz Yisrael.
I'm not sure. We have much more of a knowledge of Amoraim because you have the sense of.
I don't know if there's a change in the Masorah, or there's a change in the.
During the time period of the Tanoim, so there's still, depending on when you're talking about, the Eretz Yisrael was running the show.
So my question is basically, how did the communities outside of Eretz Yisrael hear the news? is from Eretz Yisrael.
I was challenging. The farther away, the harder it was. And that's why they still had the whole Kiddush Yad, yet them keeping 2 days. And Eretz Yisrael was only keeping 1 day, right? We were discussing this recently, right? That they were keeping 2 days on Tiff. It took a long time for messages to get to them. It wasn't so posh. So that takes us to the time period of the Amoraim. The end period, the end, by the time of the end of the Amoraim, it's already, you have the Christians and the Muslims that they're running the world at the time. And that's very significant for Klal Yisrael and how they're functioning, how well they're being able to function wherever they're living. Because historically, wherever Islam was in power, the Jews were doing well. Wherever the Christians were in power, so then this is very squarely. A lot of persecution with the Christians. So after the end, so the Gemara is written down, the Talmud Bavli is written down by the late Amoraim. And then you have this sketchy period that everyone calls the period of the Ga'inim. So who are some of the Ga'inim? You know any names of the Ga'inim? So first of all, they say there's Savoroim before the Ga'inim. That in between the two is this great period called Savoroim. That there were certain personalities that maybe edited certain parts of the Gemara or finished up the Bavli to the way that we have it today. We know very little about that. But then you have Rav Haigoin, you have certain Ga'inim that we know about. We have some of their works. But, you know, we're not as familiar with them, and it's not the kinds of things that typically people are focusing on. And then becomes a time period that we call what?
Rishonim.
The Rishonim. So what's happening in the world? Like, what's going on? So we're talking about the 900s now, something like that. 900, 1000, you have Rashi. So where are people in the world at this time? So you have Ashkenaz and Sfarad starting to really define themselves differently at this point. Because you have Jews that have been far away from each other for hundreds of years. And you have no Beis HaMikdash for hundreds of years. And so the unity of Klal Yisrael is starting to falter. And really our communities are developing very differently from one another in different places. So what were the main places? So in Spain, once Islam took over in Spain, so then the Jews flourished over there. And it's interesting that what the Jews were doing in Spain was not just learning Torah. There was a lot of poetry, there was a lot of philosophy, there was a lot of music, there was a lot of other things that were happening. Ramchal wrote like poems. Like, he's a tremendous poet.
Wasn't he
Italian? He was in Amsterdam. He was in all different places. But the Ramban, like all these people, like they wrote Piyutim, like they wrote, it's interesting that all those places that there was a tremendous Muslim influence, it seems like the Jews were very much branching out into a lot of other things. Whereas, if you take a look, France and Germany, you could really throw together. So if you kind of like look at it sort of like a very sketchy map, you have like France and Germany sort of on the top. And in the bottom, you'll have Spain, like you guys, it's Spain over here, and you have, you know, Italy on the other side. And then in the middle, what you have is this area called, like, you know, the Provence, which is originally part of, you know, France and that type of area. But then things got a little sketchy, and then it became a little closer to Spain. So that kind of fluctuated a little bit. So what happened was, the main Torah center is where? Bav. How did Chachamim end up leaving Babel, going to other places? How did Torah spread? How did the yeshivas spread? Like, how did that work? So it's fascinating. There's like one main event that really had a tremendous impact. So it's called the Four Captives. Four captives were three great goyim, and the fourth one, someone else, but it seems like we're not really sure who it was. So it was about 990 of the Common Era. The names were Rav Moshe ben Chanoich, Rav Chushiel, Rav Shmaria ben Elchanan, and the fourth one, we're not exactly sure who he was. So they set sail on a ship from southern Italy, and they were captured. And they were, I don't know, the guy's name was Ibn Rumahis or something, a Moorish Spanish pirate who was in the service of the Spanish Caliph, who decided to offer them for ransom to four different Jewish communities along the Mediterranean coast. So these are personalities, you know, they're learning, they've probably spent their whole life learning in Babel. And they're traveling, and they got ransomed to these different communities. Rav Moshe, along with his son Chanoich, was ransomed by Cordova under the leadership of Chasda ibn Shaprut. And they said, wow, this guy's awesome. Will you be the rabbi? He became the leader of the entire community. And it happened to all of them. So what happened was, they decided, this is crazy. There's so many Jews here. There's a massive community. There's no main Torah center. It's all in Babel. We've got to change these. These things have to start here. And because of this unbelievable act of Hashkacha, that they started these major Torah centers in other places. So that's already, you know, the early Rishonim time. This is the Goyim. But early Rishonim is 990. So this is right in between the Goyim and the Rishonim. So that's how things began to spread, and yeshivas began to pop up other places.
So where did they end up?
All four of them? So one of them was in Cordova.
Cordova, Spain. Right?
Spain. And let's see. Of Kushiel went to Tunisia. That's in North Africa. Where's the third one? Rishmari ben Elchanan ended up in Egypt. So that's ultimately precursor of the Rambam in a certain sense, you know, because that's where he ended up. No, I'm saying we needed that to happen so that they would be there. Such a gadol b'Yisrael would be there and have the capacity, the drive, and the ratzon, you know, to create a yeshiva in that place that would change the entire face of that city for sure, much far more farsha than the city, in the whole country. So that's what's happening in Spain. So as long as Spain was run by the Muslims, so the Jews were doing really well. Of course, if you want to focus on Spain for a minute, so ultimately what happened over there over the next few hundred years?
Inquisition.
So it becomes Christian. And then, you know, that's ultimately the Jews are thrown out. Julian goes back to Morocco? Who's the one that's from Morocco? Julian? You're also from Morocco? Your family? The origins of the early Jewish settlements in Morocco are shrouded in mystery. The origin, how Jews got to Morocco, nobody knows. I don't know. The Jewish communities in the Atlas Mountains claim to have originated during the reign of Shlomo HaMelech. But the Amoraim, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Chisda, it says in the Gemara, west of Carthage, they don't know about Eretz Yisrael. There's nobody religious over there. I don't know. Anyway, so that's what happened. You want to trace each one of these communities back, so some of them are easier to trace back, some of them are harder. We know like Mitzrayim, Alexandria, for example, the shul in Alexandria, remember the flags? Everyone's heard that Gemara, right? That when they would say, when time to say Amen, they would wave the flags and would say Amen. That was the Gemara talks about. I mean, we're talking, that was an early community. They just never had these tremendous yeshivas until the four captives, you know, spread out.
So when did the yeshivas, like in Germany, start?
Okay, so let's discuss that. That's Ashkenazim need to know these things.
It seems like it's only about this far in right now. It seems like it's
because Ashkenazim are a much of a community of the sort.
She says like this. So obviously, Babel was, you know, Babylonia was the main source of everything, but that's already in Eretz Yisrael. That's outside
Nineveh. Nineveh was the center of Torah learning, huh?
I don't know.
What's Nineveh? Nineveh.
Where is Nineveh exactly? It's in Iran or something?
I think it's like in Iran or something. Area.
Okay.
The
early history of the Jews. So France and Germany were basically going to throw together. It's interesting because the two countries had a lot to do with each other. When a lot of places were shutting off their borders for whatever reason, France and Germany seemed to always go together. The correspondences between France and Germany always seemed to go through.
It's because of the Carolings.
Because what?
Because of the Carolings. The rulers of France and Germany were always related in this area.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Okay. So, interestingly enough, very little is known about the Yidden in those countries before around the 10th century, around the times of the early Rishonim. It's very sketchy. Tradition relates some Jews arrived even prior to the first Beis HaMikdash. He asked Mari Makomos for that, if you're interested. But it seems to have sort of like popped up. It basically begins with Rabbeinu Gershom. Yeah, are we familiar with Rabbeinu Gershom? Rashi quotes Rabbeinu Gershom, that he was known as Rabbeinu Gershom Bar HaGoyla. And so he was in France. So I guess we're going to have to say that whatever Yiddishkeit started is going to have to either be somehow begins with him. So basically, what we call, you know, Chachmei Ashkenaz, when we think about the Jews and the personalities of France and Germany, so who are we talking about? Who were the famous personalities? Who are we talking about? Well, that's Rashi. Later. Rashi, and of course the Balei HaTosfos. That many of the early Tosafists, if you will, we'll try to describe them a little bit soon. So those were all basically descendants of Rashi. Rabbeinu Tam, Rashbam. So we have is Rabbeinu Gershom setting up a certain style of learning that was somehow different. I don't pinpoint it yet to speak to a better expert than me. That was different than the styles that were happening in other places in Sephardi lands. And that developed into some kind of tremendous Messiah. What is Rashi? How does Tosis refer to Rashi? Perish ha... ha what? Ha kuntris. Right? You know what I'm talking about? What's kuntris? What's a kuntris?
Something French,
kuntris means a booklet. It means like a notebook. Kuntris. Perish ha kuntris.
Pamphlet.
Pamphlet, whatever. A booklet. It means these were the official yeshiva notes. There were official yeshiva notes that were going around in France, Germany, and those areas. Rashi was the one that made it Perish Rashi. I don't know, whatever he did. He consolidated it, he edited it, whatever he did. He was like the expert note taker, you know?
He wasn't just in there.
No, he was a development of his entire Messiah. Sometimes he'll say, you know, my Rebbeim said like this, you know, sometimes he'll agree, disagree, whatever, he'll quote it all. But he was basically taking a tremendous Messiah, and he was making it his own, with his own angles and his own way of presenting it, etc., etc. But it wasn't like Rashi came in a total vacuum. Perish HaKuntris. That this was a Kuntris that had been going around, that was the Messiah of the whole France and German Jews, that of the learning over there. What is interesting is that you don't find a lot of philosophy. You don't find music. You don't find all those things that are happening in the Muslim areas. Of course, France and Germany were Christian. So it was a different focus altogether. Now, what happens with Rashi, of course, is that the whole kuntris is focused on Pshat and Gemara. Right? What's Pshat and Gemara? What would you say is the agenda of Tosfos?
Honestly, that's what it is. Let you understand the deeper level. You want to get a grasp on the deeper level.
Well, sort of. The only reason it ends up being that is because of their goal. Yeah, it's to put it all together. Is that whereas you don't, sometimes you do, you don't generally get the impression that Rashi is relating to a parallel Gemara in another Masechta. He will sometimes, but not always. And a lot of times Rashi will just say a pshat, and you have to wonder, is Rashi saying a pshat to answer a question? That's a question on the sugi when it appears in Masechta Shabbos? Or Rashi's ignoring it and just saying pshat on this page? It's hard to know. We try to make the assumption that Rashi was aware of it, and you can try to be medayik in Rashi and say, well, Rashi, m'stam anu l'gemara, so like, how is he answering the question that I'm going to have, because there's a contradiction between the way it's presented and the way it's presented there. Tosfos asks that as an explicit question. And Tosfos says, you know, what's going on over here? So that was the goal of basically Tosfos, is to take all of these passages all over Shas and make sense out of all of them, and it should be one homogeneous whole. Yeah? So, right, that was a major focus. So that's what gives what we call the Balei HaTosfos, that's what gives them their own, like, special place in the Messiah. That whereas, if you have a lot of Mefarshim, you have the Ramban, you have the Rashba, so they have their Chidushim, And there are a lot of times, you know, following the same issues that are going on in Tosfos. But Tosfos is famous for trying to put it all together. If you want to separate Germany from France, so it was a little different. That in Germany, there wasn't the same type of focus on, I don't want to say this, it's going to sound a little bad, on almost like the academic way of learning the Gemara. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that you don't always find Tosfos saying anything halacha l'maisa. Sometimes he'll say, Rabbeinu Tam, I actually paskin like this. You know, like every once in a while, you'll find that. But in general, he's just trying to make it this homogeneous whole. In Germany, they were much more focused on halacha l'maisa. So you'll find Balei HaTosfos, people coming from the same school of thought, ultimately starting with Rabbeinu Gershom and Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam, those, that whole yeshiva style and structure and Masaira, but their focus, the Or Zarua was one of the Balei HaTosfos, their focus, the Rav Yoa, on what's the halach lamaisa out of all of this. When do you start to find any real development of halach lamaisa? So I think, did we discuss this when we started talking about the Mishnah Berurah and Shulchan Aruch? Did we discuss a little bit about halach lamaisa, how it comes to... All right, so we'll try to put that together too a little bit. So that's what's happening. France and Germany, Spain, Italy. So you have what's going on over there. In Egypt, things are happening. In Tunisia, in North Africa, things are happening. And so Torah is spreading. And each one has a slightly different way of approaching things because they don't all have the same Masorah. The Masorah of Rashi and the Tosfos was not exactly what's going on in Spain. Certainly not what's going on in North Africa. Morocco, like what's going on in Morocco? They don't have the... So what were the main Sfarim that sort of like carried over? So when things became more halach lamaisa, I guess you can say, when there were greater works. So what's, of course, the most famous one that had a big Shulchan Aruch was much later. But what's the first one? So the earliest was the Rif. Where was the Rif? Fez.
Spain.
Morocco. What? Yeah.
It's
Morocco. Fez. So he was the first one to try and focus a little more on halacha l'maaseh. What he did essentially was cut out all of the Shabbat Vatari and the Gemara. What's the conclusion? I'm interested in all of the conversations. But okay, you still got to roll the entire Shas, you got to know all of the Rif to put it all together. Sometimes the Namasech, you didn't put it together like an encyclopedia, in the manner of like an encyclopedia. So it's hard to look things up, figuring that. So the main, what changed the world was the Rambam. The Rambam was where? Started off in Spain, but he was in Egypt. So the Rambam, who was the Sfarim, so he put together an encyclopedia of Kol HaTorah Kula. So everyone that saw this knew right away that this was a masterpiece. I mean, this is not a partial thing. It's not like he had cut and paste, you know what I mean? Like, this was a massive work that he was culling everything and reorganizing everything by topic. I mean, it's honestly not fathomable how in the time of the Rambam a person could do this. I mean, I don't know if you could appreciate it, but to take all the information that the Rambam had at his fingertips, which when you're learning Shas, no problem, right? You go through the topic and, oh yeah, I think it talks about this in Megillah, right? You know what I mean? The Rambam had that all in his brain, restructured all of it, and then put it together by topic. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So that changed the world. As that spread, everybody started reacting to it, responding to it. Some places it became an issue because the Rambam had Yesod HaTorah and he had certain philosophical points. That became an issue in a lot of places. People vary against some of the things the Rambam was saying. The Rambam was a controversial character when it came to his philosophy, no question about it. And then the fact that the Rambam didn't give Mari Magomos and say where he got all of his information from, so that also created a big problem. Well, who are you? Why are you saying like this? There are other opinions. What about all of this? So even though the Rambam intended his Sefer to be basically a replacement of Torah Shebaal Peh, you need a Chumash, you need a Rambam, it didn't really end up that way because there's so much discussion over the Rambam that it caused a lot of Torah to be spread, a lot more to learn than just the Rambam. So it never really ended up, maybe in Morocco, but other places never ended up that the Rambam became what he anticipated it should. So what ended up happening was that at the end of that period of the Rishonim, so you have is it basically ended in Germany. Germany was a terrible place to live throughout Jewish history. The persecutions in Germany were always terrible. And the rush, also we have to go a step before that, the Maram, Rotenberg. You've heard of Rotenberg. So there was a famous personality, Maram Mirotenberg. That was one of the later Balei HaTosfos. And the Maram was the main leader in Germany. What happened to him? Anybody know?
He got killed.
He was put in jail.
Oh, right. He was a captive.
He was put in jail. And he wanted an astronomical amount of money from the Jewish community to ransom him.
And he refused that.
And Maram said, you can't do it. It's too much. It's astronomical. And his Talmud, the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, so he said, the Gadol Hador doesn't have an amount. So he was raising the money. And in the meantime, so the Maram died in jail. The Rush freaked out, so to speak, because he thought that they're just going to take him. So he ran away. So he ran away to Spain.
What did he do with the money?
I'm not sure how much was collected. I don't know either.
But that's at the precedent that... What's it again? There's a sugya in Gemara about
yeah.
Give money for captives.
The Rush held that the Gadol Hador doesn't have a map. That's it. He's different. But you're right. It's a problem. It's a practical problem. Yeah.
That's a sign. Because he passed away, they couldn't even get the money in order to get him out.
Yeah. What ended up happening was, I forgot the name of the guy, was a really rich guy who ransomed his body because he wanted to be buried next to him. But in any case, so the Rush ended up fleeing to Spain. So that was fascinating because that's one of the times that you have a significant overlap between Mamish, one of the Balei HaTosfos coming from the Maram, and then it'd be a total exposure to Spanish Judaism. And so the Rush has a lot of interesting things that he saw in Spain. And then the Rush himself created a work that was really an explanation of the Rif. So it's very much a Tosfos, but it has a lot of halacha lemaisa in it because he's trying to get to, okay, so the Rif says like this, what is the halacha? So the Rush is very much a halachic work despite the fact that it's really a commentary on the Rif, but that's in the back of every Gemara, the Rush. You know what I'm talking about? The back of every Gemara, the Rush. So the Rush son, so that's what we call the Tur. So the Tur, what he did was he's after the Rambam. Rush is also after the Rambam. So the Tur reorganized it into four Turim, four rows, just like the Choshen. It's a four row, the Arba Turim. What are the four Turim? The four categories that the Tur formulated, do you remember? Well, Orach Chaim, Yerideya, think women, Ebenezer, and Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat is financial issues, Ebenezer is women issues. Rechaim is daily life issues, Chagim, and Yeridei is everything else. Yeridei is a lot of things in there. Shechita, I don't know, but it's a lot of stuff. So that's how he formulated it. And what he did was, okay, the Rif says like this, my father, the Rush says like this, the Rashba says like this, the Rambam says like this, we got all these opinions. So he collected the opinions more or less. It doesn't give you such a great sense of, you know, at the end of the day, so what am I supposed to do, you know? It's a lot of opinions. So that kind of is the changeover period between the Rishonim and the Achronim. So by the way, at that point, that was the end of German Judaism. I mean, that was the end of the yeshivas over there. They were, you know, kicking people out, and there was tremendous persecution and everything else. That was really the end of that. So Jews, of course, had to find wherever they were going to go. They moved primarily over to Poland, more into that direction. So you have that beginning of the changeover to what we call Achronim. So what ended up happening, just to kind of to get to an end over here a little bit, is that you have a lot of Shailos and Tshuvos happening. You have a lot of Halacha Lamaisa focus at this point. That at the end of the Rishonim period, there's not the same type of focus on the Gemara anymore, because it's like the Rishonim are the ones that are Mefarish the Gemara, and now we take those different approaches and we say, okay, how does that now apply to all kinds of issues, Halacha Lamaisa? And that became the real focus when we would call the Achronim. Now that isn't to say that you don't find Achronim, you know, trying to figure out different explanations of the Gemara and try to work out the Gemara differently in that way. Like, it's true. But it really became the development of halacha lemaisa. So, or at least that's what we have, at least in terms of Sfarim, you know. So, if you want to focus on the halacha lemaisa for a minute, so what happened was, who's the main personality, of course, is Rabbi Yosef Cairo. So Rabbi Yosef Cairo, see, he got to work on two different things. Number one was he got to work on the Torah. So what did he do on the Torah? On the Torah, he gave you the background. It's unbelievable to read. If you want, like, the cliff notes, so Tarsh Baal Peh, so it's the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef is his commentary to the Torah. So again, what did the Torah do? The Torah took all those opinions, like the Rif and the Rashba and the Rambam and the Rosh, and he says, okay, these are the different opinions. And the Beis Yosef comes along and he says, okay, where are they all getting it from? So instead of you going back to Shas and learning all Shas all over again, he has a summary of all of the background to what they're arguing about there. Often, he will then say, okay, and since the majority of those poskim that the Torah is quoting, the majority of them goes a certain way, so that's how we should paskim. And more often than not, that's what he records when he wrote what he calls the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is exactly the same structure as the Torah. So whatever simon, whatever halakhas appear in the Torah, is exactly the same simon in Shulchan Aruch. It's just that what he did was he took out all the other opinions most of the time. And he says, okay, this is what we do. Now, at the same time that was happening, again, the Jews had shifted to a great deal to Poland. So who's in Poland? The Ramah, Rav Moshe Israelis. So Rav Moshe Israelis sees all this going on, and he says, okay, but that's not exactly our Messiah. You're focusing on the Sfardim. But what about the Bali HaTaisis? What about the other opinions that we have over there in Ashkenaz? So he says, so we don't always agree with what it says in Shulchan Aruch. So that's why he wrote the Ramah, the Mappa, the tablecloth to the Shulchan Aruch, the tablecloth to the set table. So he records over there all the Ashkenazi opinions. So sometimes it differs. So that's how you end up with what we call the Shulchan Aruch from all of that background. It's the bringing together of two worlds, which is an interesting thing.
And then the Mishnah Berurah
comes along later on, the Chafetz Chaim. Where was the Chafetz Chaim? Radin, in Poland also. So it comes along Chafetz Chaim, and so he brings together a lot of the other Mefarshim that made comments on the Shulchan Aruch. There'd become a lot of discussion over the Shulchan Aruch itself, and over the Ramah, over the Mechaber, one of the more famous opinions, the Magen Avraham, but also the Taz, a lot of opinions. So as things began to branch out, and there became a lot of issues over things, so Mishnah Berurah tried to concretize them again and bring them together again, and say, okay, so like, you know, what do we do? Halacha lemaisa, things have changed a little bit from Shulchan Aruch, although he does a lot of explanation also a little bit. But to make things just kind of like, okay, let's bring it all together. You know, let's what do I do? What do I mean? He says this. Bring it back all together. And nowadays, everybody's publishing things that are mostly focused on, you know, halach lamaisa, details that came up, things that change. What do you do about this? When this changes, what do you do about new developments, like electricity? What do you do about this and that, the other thing? So that's what you see, especially all the English stuff today. There's a lot of English on halach lamaisa. Now, what happens with English books on halach lamaisa bisman hazeh? It serves to absolutely and totally confuse everybody about halacha. Because no one that writes these English books is a pesach.
Now, Rav Avadia was.
Yeah.
And his son translated.
Okay. So Chacham Avadia, so he can give a pesach. But you have a typical person that's trying to help people to understand halacha. So he writes an English book, and he says, and there are 400 opinions.
So we're good.
He was an interesting personality. He brought a lot of the Sephardi world together. He really did.
It used to be that Rabbein knew like everything about everything. Now they usually specialize in a single area.
Okay, sometimes. But I think, personally, I think the biggest problem we face bizman hazeh is lack of poiskim. That I have the problem myself. You know, people ask me, I gave a shiur last night, because the pasuk in Noach talks about shalom echdam adam ba'adam, it talks about esdimchem lenafshei seichem, so a lot of issues of murder. So, esdimchem lenafshei seichem is talking about suicide. So I had, there's a sefer, Zilberstein, you guys see this, Bahar Revna? I think they translated it in English. I don't know what it's called in English. It's fascinating shilas. that came up. Like really sometimes crazy things and sometimes, you know, just really fascinating things. So he asked the Shiloh apparently after whichever war it was that was in Eretz Yisrael recently. So there was a big issue of concern that soldiers were going to get captured. And so a lot of the commanders told the soldiers, you know, you always have a grenade on you, blow yourself up so you don't get captured. Are you as a person allowed to kill himself so he doesn't get captured? The issue of suicide. So what does he do? So in the Sefer, basically he goes through all the different approaches in the post-game. So of course, everyone's going to say to you, so Rabbi, you know, what's the psak? You know, so I can't give a psak. I'm posek, you know, I'm a rabbi. I collect opinions. I'll tell you what the opinions are, you know. So that's the problem that we face, Bizman Hazeh. It frustrates a lot of people. Because people feel like there's no answer to anything. And if there is an answer to everything, what does it mean? It means that you go to a posek, Rav David Feinstein. He'll tell you how it is. Boom. 1, 2, 3. Often Rosh Hashanah will. The Rosh Hashanah sometimes will give you, you know, different opinions and not so poshut. But sometimes he'll say straight up, this is the way I think this is the poshut shot. So you have a posek, so they can, you know, cut through all of that and say this is what I feel. But yes, what's going to happen is you're going to go to somebody else who went to a different posek who concluded differently. So that's the world that we live in, Bizman Hazeh. So since most Rabbanim are not poskim, are not qualified to be poskim, so you end up with Rabbanim basically saying, okay, there are a lot of opinions. I certainly can't give you a psak. So you end up with a lot of chumras.
Not good.
Not good. Not good. But, unfortunately, that's where all of this galus has brought us to. So, you have Moshe Rabbeinu, you have Torah Shebi'al Sa, you have Torah Shebi'al Peh. You have Klal Yisrael getting sent around the world because of galus. You have communities developing in different places. You have four captives being ransomed to those places, ultimately, to spread the Torah to those places. You have the differentiation of Torah. You have the development of Torah on different levels in terms of philosophy, more in Sephardi types of places than Ashkenazi places, because most people attribute it to the persecution in the Christian areas as opposed to the Muslim places where there's a lot of freedom. So people felt a lot of freedom to develop in all those other ways. Ashkenazim, the Litvisha Yidin, the Ashkenazim, you know, much more dry, if you will. And the Sephardi are much more colorful. And then it spread and it spread and it spread. Are we coming back together in Eretz Yisrael? Doesn't seem like it. Seems like everybody's back physically in Eretz Yisrael. But in terms of the different approaches in Yiddishkeit, so we're just as far away as we were geographically,
no.
Despite the fact that geographically we're a lot closer.
No, that's, I think only the separation between the Haredim and not Haredim. The
Sfarim Hashem. You get involved in this Chassidim and these Chassidim, and they don't listen to this one and that one and this and that and Litvish and this. Everybody's very far away. And we didn't even get involved in Hasidus. We didn't get involved in any of that stuff. Just in terms of general, the Hasidim, you know, learned the same Torah as everybody else, but they have their own angles and ways of anyway. But that's at least a basic gist. Do you have any specific questions that before we go?
Okay. Yeah, does anybody know if the logo shuttle runs today?
Rabbeinu Nisim, Svardi. Yeah. The Ran was in the period of the Rishon, but he was a later Rishon. He quotes a lot of the earlier ones, a later Rishon.